Please turn with me in your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 26. That's where we are in our study of the life of David. You know, this is turning out to be a rather lengthy sermon series. And we're not really anywhere at all along the way so far as being almost finished or anything like that. And I'll be the first to admit that we're probably going to have to accelerate this thing a little bit pretty soon because we don't want it to turn into a 3-year study. And I almost decided to consolidate this chapter with another one or two tonight, but I decided to take one more night in slow gear, and then maybe next Sunday night, Lord willing, we'll turn this thing into something that makes a little bit more forward progress than what we've seen thus far. I've called tonight's sermon Sparing the King Again. As I tried to figure out a good title to put on the sign out front for tonight's sermon, I almost really wanted to call it God Save the King Again. Because, you know, really it was because David was doing God's will that he preserved Saul's life on the first occasion in chapter 24 and now again in chapter 26. But I think it was Brother Leonard Johnson that taught us back in Alabama Christian College in preacher's class, preparation and delivery of sermons or something like that, that you should never use a title for a sermon that requires very much of an explanation. And I've already broken the rules last Sunday morning when I preached on God Hates Shorts, you know. And so I figured tonight I might not better call it God Save the King, lest I give the wrong impression, though it was God who saved the king in actuality. So far as PowerPoint goes, that's all you're going to get up there right now. So enjoy that one. This chapter is divided up, at least in the translation I'm using, into 5 different paragraphs. And we're going to just take it paragraph at a time and sort of summarize the paragraphs. And then at the conclusion of our study, I've got 4 important lessons that I want to share with you, and that'll really just be brief. Let's think a minute about some timing or some chronology, and let me preface that by saying that whatever we decide is the case so far as how long all of this is taking is just really anybody's best guess. There are some things that we do know for sure. We know for sure that according to chapter 13, verse 1, that Saul reigned over Israel for 42 years. And everything that we read from chapter 13 all the way to chapter 31 covers a time span of 42 years because chapter 31 tells of Saul's death. In between those two boundaries, we're kind of at the mercy of commentators and everybody's best guess as to how to divide all of this up. One of the things that I've always found helpful, though never without double-checking it with some knowledgeable commentators, the Thompson Chain Reference Bible has dates at each chapter heading in the Old Testament. Now, many of those dates will have a question mark after them. So you can't say for sure that date is exactly right, but through the years of my study, I've found that those dates, at least in the time frames that they outline, have been fairly in line with most commentators. There'll be some differences occasionally. If you use the dates that are given in the Thompson Chain Reference Bible, this really takes place at a time about, Saul's about 60 years old in chapter 26. This is about probably 28 years after David has been anointed. Now, probably the first 3 or 4 years, everything was good. Maybe 5 or 6 years, things were fairly peaceful. But after about that long, David basically has hit the road and been running for his life for all of the rest of that time. And I mention that because in just casual reading through, you might get the impression that everything from chapter 13 all the way to chapter 31 takes place over the span of a couple of years. But that's not the case. It's a much longer, drawn-out period of time. So, with that in mind, let's begin with the first paragraph, which in this translation covers verses 1 through 5. In this paragraph, we're told about what I've called Saul's secret service of whining spies, the Ziphites. You see, this is the second time that they've come to Saul and says, "I guess you know that David is hiding out over there near our place." The first time, you'll recall, a few chapters back, they came to Saul and reported that, and Saul and his army of 3,000 men took off after David and pretty much caught David and his men by surprise. And the Bible describes how that Saul and his men were going around one side of the mountain and David and his men were coming around the other side, and they were about to be surrounded when God seemingly intervened, because it was at that time that a messenger came to Saul and says, "You're needed back at home because the Philistines have attacked our people." And so Saul and his men abandoned the chasing after David and went back. Now the second time, the Ziphites have come to Saul saying, "Is not David hiding on the hill of Hakilah, which is before Jeshimon?" And so immediately Saul then rose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph and took his 3,000-man army. Now that was not all of the soldiers that Israel had. That was the number of trusted, highly regarded men that Saul kept with him at all time at his disposal. The best of the best, the cream of the crop, the fighting men of Saul. And so they took off after David. Now, what was it about these Ziphites, you know? I mean, anybody that has to go by that name all of their lives, there's probably going to be something wrong with them anyway, you know. "Hey, man, who are you?" "I'm one of those Ziphites." "You're what?" "I'm a Ziphite." I'm not sure. I'm probably being a little unfair to them based on that, but it seems that they have a propensity for being tattletales. They are... This time, it only makes sense that they would really be against David, because remember, they've already turned David in one time. Remember, we're talking about a time when somebody did you bad, somebody had treated you wrong. What did you do to them? Well, you made them pay. You taught them a lesson. And so the Ziphites, more than anybody, needed Saul's protection against David. It was in their best interest that Saul hurry up and get this guy out of the picture, because they'd already ratted on him one time, and they certainly were not going to be on David's good list. And so now, at their urging, Saul goes to the wilderness of Ziph with his chosen men to search for David. And it tells us there in that first paragraph that Saul and his men camped in the hill of Hakilah, which is before Jeshimon, beside the road. And David, though, was staying in the wilderness. And I think what that means is David and his men were very mobile. They were not about to get caught in another ambush like they had almost gotten caught in before. And verse 4 says that David then sent out spies, and he knew that Saul was definitely coming. Now, not trying to belabor the point, but I want you to notice the contrast in that descriptive language with the way that the previous encounter, where Saul and his men had almost slipped up on David. This time, David knows what's going on. He sends out spies who come back to him and tell him where Saul and his men are. And so when David had good enough intelligence, so far as information was concerned, it says in verse 5, he arose and came to the place where Saul had camped. And David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army, and Saul was lying in the circle of the camp, and the people were camped around him. A lot of commentators say that David had really gone up and personally scoped out the camp of Saul while it was still daytime. And so he knew the layout of the camp. And then what transpires next probably took place a few hours later, maybe in the middle of the night. David goes to his men and he says to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, saying, I need a volunteer. I need somebody to go with me to Saul's camp. Now, let me slow down here for just a second and point out the introduction of a couple of new characters in this story. Not just casual characters that you won't ever hear about anymore, but two names that will be prominently mentioned for the rest, or for a great portion of the rest of the story of David. There is, first of all, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah. In the story of David, all total, he's mentioned about 24 times. This is the first mention of him, and he is the one who is remembered for being at David's side on the occasion when David was fleeing from Jerusalem because his son Absalom had taken his throne and driven him out, and David was fleeing for his life and going along the road. And old Shimei was up on the ridge above them, and the Bible says he was throwing dirt and rocks down on David, talking about how sorry David was and how that David deserved to die. Shimei was obviously on Absalom's side. And it was Abishai who said on that occasion to David, why is this dead dog permitted to curse the king? Let me go and take off his head. That kind of shows you what kind of fellow Abishai was. He was one of the mighty men of David who believed in getting things done, and usually the sooner the better. He was the kind of guy you really wanted on your side in a conflict, and you didn't want to think about him being on the other side. The rest of that story is for another time, but basically David said, let him alone. Actually, what he's saying is pretty much deserved on my part. But now, back to 1 Samuel chapter 26. Abishai is also identified as Joab's brother. This is the first time that Joab's name is mentioned in the account of David, but Joab will later become David's right-hand man. He'll be the commander-in-chief of the forces under the king. He'll be the supreme commander of the soldiers. His name will come up about 120 times before the story of David comes to an end. And Joab, you may remember, after Saul's death, David had become king of Judah. Saul's son had become king of the rest of the tribes, and there was constant fighting between them. And Abner, the chief of Saul's forces, was then playing a leadership role, and Abner decided to switch sides and to come over to David's side and to persuade all of the people to acknowledge David as king. And it would be Joab who hated Abner badly because Abner had killed Joab's other brother, not Abishai, but their other brother. It just so happens that Joab and Abishai's brother was chasing after Abner, trying to kill him, when the Bible says that Abner let him get close enough and thrust his spear backward so that the butt of his spear went into his stomach and came out his back. That was a lot of force. Of course, it described that young man as one who could run with the speed of a gazelle. At any rate, he was killed. And because Joab had killed, or because Abner had killed Joab's brother, even though the boy was chasing Joab trying to kill him, Joab hated him, and Joab would later kill Abner. And David mourned Abner greatly. But that's, again, something for a later time. David says to his men, I need a volunteer. And Abishai says, I'll go with you. And so David and Abishai came down, it says there, by night. And they saw the camp there. And in the camp, Saul, of course, was asleep in the middle of the... They normally would have assembled all of the supply wagons and so forth in a circle, and the soldiers would be in and out of that circle asleep, and in the very middle would be the king sleeping, and the custom was that his spear would have been driven down into the ground where his head lay. And his chief of staff, Abner, would have been right there by his side. And David saw all of this, and Abishai says to David basically the same thing that his men had said to him in the cave previously when they had an opportunity to kill Saul. Today God has delivered your enemy into your hand. Now therefore, please let me strike him with the spear to the ground with one stroke, and I will not strike him the second time. Well, that's interesting terminology, but what he really means is, if you'll let me, I'll kill him with one stroke of my spear, and he won't make a sound, and you won't have to do anything, and we'll be out of here. But David said to Abishai, this is the first of the two occasions when David had to call Abishai down, do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt? David also said, as the Lord lives, surely the Lord will strike him, or his day will come that he dies, or he will go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed, but now please take the spear that is at his head and the jug of water and let us go. I have a question here. Why was it this way now, when just in the previous chapter, it wasn't that way with Nabal? You remember we talked about it in the last two study sessions. With Nabal, David was bent on giving him just exactly what he deserved. He was such a mean fellow. And David, of course, was talked out of that revenge by Abigail, Nabal's wife, who would later become David's wife. Why don't we see any of that kind of reaction and response out of David towards Saul? Because Saul has, we've already said, it's been probably 25 years now. Saul's been chasing David and trying to kill him to prevent him from being king, because David surely was the one that God was talking about when he said through the prophet Samuel, God has decided it's time to search out a man after his own heart, and your kingdom will not endure forever. Why such a contrast? Why didn't David want to teach Saul a lesson? And in this whole thing, it could be done so simply. Two things. Number one, as he says over and over again, I will not raise my hand against the Lord's anointed. there was a difference between Saul and Nabal, though they were both engaged in an activity that was far from anything that God would have approved of. There was a difference because Saul was the king, and he was the king by God's authority. I have always felt that you and I don't understand all of the ramifications about that fact and the sacredness of David's attitude toward the Lord's anointed. Now, granted, David was unlike a lot of folks in the Old Testament during the times of the kings, because the Bible tells us again and again of folks who of the king's own staff who killed the king. But David refused to do it. The second thing that comes to mind here as to why David didn't have a vengeful attitude toward Saul, especially now that Saul, after having said, "I'm going to leave you alone, you're okay, I'm okay, everything's good," you know, back in chapter 24, "I'm sorry, you're a better man than I am, you've done righteously, I've done wickedly." Now Saul's come after him again. You got to conclude that David had learned a really important spiritual lesson right back there in chapter 25 at the hands of Abigail. In fact, David himself admitted, he said, "You have kept me from doing something terrible." Even though Nabal, by his own conduct and behavior, was the kind of guy that was just acting like he wanted somebody to put him out of his misery, David wasn't the one to do it, because that wouldn't have been right. There are other things, I'm sure, and other lessons that we could draw from that, but those two things come to mind. The third paragraph, verses 13 through 16, we're going to get to in just a second, but I'm not quite through with the second one, because I just remembered there's something really important here at the end of this paragraph. It says that David took the spear and the jug of water from beside Saul's head and then went away, but no one saw or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep because a sound sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. Not really a very high probability of two men being able to sneak into the camp of 3,000, even though you've seen John Wayne do it 100 times, not really real that you could sneak into the camp and take the king's spear and his canteen from right there beside his head, and nobody stirred or even woke up except and without God's help in this. God, in his providential care, his care that provides so richly, had caused this sleep to come upon them. Okay, we've got Saul's spear and we've got his canteen or his cruse of water, his water jug. And it says that David went up on the top of the mountain at a distance, a safe distance, we would say, and then he calls back to the camp. And he calls out Abner first, because if everything had been as it appeared, Abner's transgression was the greatest. In fact, in normal times of those times, Abner really should have been put to death because he had fallen down in his duties. Of course, you got to take into consideration God's role in this thing. But David calls out to the people and to Abner and says, "Will you not answer, Abner?" "Hey, Abner, wake up, man." Abner says, "Who is this that's calling to the king? Who is this that's interrupting the king's sleep? What's going on here?" David said to Abner, "Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For one of the people came in to destroy the king, your lord. This thing that you've done is not good. As the Lord lives, all of you must surely die because you did not guard your Lord, the Lord's anointed. And now, see where the king's spear is and the jug of water that was at his head. And though the Bible doesn't say it, I guarantee you every head in the camp turned to look where Saul had been laying. And they saw that his spear wasn't there. Historians tell us, in fact, that even today among some of the nomadic tribes of that area, it is still the practice of the leader of the people to sleep in a place where his spear is stuck down in the ground beside him. And so that wasn't just a casual, hey, where'd my spear go? There was something definite in that. And it was clear that something bad had happened. The next paragraph, chapter 17, or verses 17 through 20, gives the exchange between David and Saul. Saul recognized David's voice. Is that your voice, my son David? David said, it is my voice, my Lord the King. I want to point out a difference here between this verse and chapter 24, verse 11, where David, in his exchange with Saul after having spared his life in the cave, refers to him as not my Lord the King, but as my father. It was in reply to Saul's referring to David as my son. And so now here on the second occasion, Saul calls David my son. And David says, yes, it's me, my Lord the King. I'm not sure if it's the sole singular reason, but you'll remember between the last occasion and this occasion, Saul had taken David's wife, Michal, his daughter, away and given her to somebody else. Saul could truly say, he's not my son-in-law anymore. He's not married to my daughter. Just another little brick in that wall that Saul was using to isolate David. David says, why is my Lord pursuing his servant? What have I done? What evil is in my hand? And skipping down there a couple of verses, notice what David says. If it is men, cursed be they before the Lord, for they have driven me out today so that I would have no attachment with the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods. That's verse 19. Now then, do not let my blood fall to the ground away from the presence of the Lord. For the king of Israel has come out to search for a single flea, just as one hunts a partridge in the mountains. There was great significance in Jerusalem and in the land of God's people. And David was being forced totally away from his homeland. In fact, the next couple of chapters will bear out that David had literally been forced to take up residence with the enemies of God's people. And it seems that it's this fact that David brings out that gets through to Saul in a little way. Verse 21 begins the last paragraph. Then Saul said, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will not harm you again because my life was precious in your sight this day. Behold, I have played the fool and have committed a serious error. Now, you know, with the exception of another statement that's recorded right in the last verse or two of this chapter, that's about all that Saul says, and it's quite in contrast to what he'd said before when David spared his life. And commentators are pretty much in agreement that Saul seems to speak from an attitude of having been embarrassed and made to look like a bumbling fool rather than speaking from the standpoint of one who's truly penitent for what he's done. Saul says, behold, I've played the fool. You may recall back in chapter 13, verse 13, that was what Samuel told him. you have done foolishly. You've acted foolishly. That was the occasion when he refused to wait for God's prophet to come and offer the sacrifice, but served as the priest himself and offered it himself because he was impatient. He had played the fool. On this occasion, he's played the fool politically. He's played the fool militarily. He's played the fool spiritually, because he's still trying to go against God's will. Now, those four things, just in a sentence or two for each one of them. Lesson number one from this chapter: reverence God's plan. It's obvious that David had reverence for God's plan. It's obvious that Saul did not. Saul could not have possibly not realized that he was outside the will of God. From chapter 13, verse 13, all the way to this point, there was no excuse for Saul not knowing how his disregard for God's plan and God's will had gotten him into trouble over and over and over. Reverence God's plan. Number two, God's will is plain and simple. Saul didn't need some wizard to tell him what God's will was. Saul didn't need someone to interpret God's plan for him. Saul knew clearly what God's will was. It was simple. All he had to do was obey it. Lesson number three: as we serve God, His providence serves us. As we serve God, His providence will serve us. It certainly served David on this occasion with that sleep that came upon the whole camp. It had served David before, no doubt on many occasions. As we serve God, His providence will serve us. Number four, faithfulness, not shortcuts, will prepare us for the future. David was faithful to God's plan, and though he had two clear occasions that are explained to us in chapter 24 and chapter 26, occasions where he could easily have taken a shortcut to get this thing over with, to get him on the throne as the rightful king of Israel like God wanted him to be. But David knew that the shortcut wasn't the way, and that God had a purpose. Following God's plan prepares us for the future. Next Sunday night, Lord willing, we'll look further into the story of David. If you need to respond to the Master's invitation, we sing this song to encourage you and invite you to respond now as we stand and sing.